Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and thank you for choosing us for your listening pleasure today. Now, I've had a bit of a chest infection this past week, so I apologise for any rasping that may occur over the next 30 minutes or so, but luckily for my guests, we're not in the studio today, so I can't pass on any of my germs to them. I don't think you can pass on germs through a computer. My first guest is the author of 6 educational books on historical subjects and 13 psychological thrillers. Her books have been shortlisted for many awards, including the Crime Writers Association Gold Dagger, and she has won the CWA Historical Mystery Award as well. She was the programming chair for the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival in 2009 and co-programs the Killer Women Crime Writing Festival. She's also The Guardian's crime fiction reviewer and is here to tell us about her latest YA novel under a pseudonym. It's Laura Wilson. Hello.
Hello.
Lovely to see you. We're usually lunching, Laura, when we see each other, aren't we? Which makes it sound very grand. But it's lovely to see you in a professional capacity.
Yes, indeed. Without food. I don't think I've ever seen you without food before.
Yeah. I've not seen me without food either. It's lovely to have you here. And my second guest was a successful theatre costume designer before illustrating and writing books. She is a Costa and Carnegie Prize winner, and her books have been translated all over the world, selling over 2 million copies. These include I, Coriander, Maggot Moon and Tinder. And here to tell us about her latest adult novel, it's Sally Gardner. Hello to you.
Hello, hello, Joe. I'm really pleased to be here.
So lovely to see you again. And I'll do the virtual introductions here. Laura, Sally, Sally, Laura. I'm not sure if you've met before.
No, I don't think we have.
We never have, but if I can have just a fan moment for a second. I love Maggot Moon so much. it's one of my favourite
books. Me too.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Get the fan moment out of the way early, I say. Let's just get that done. And over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to talk about your latest books. We're going to get some reading recommendations from you. And of course, we will do the Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book that you love, that you think we should all read, and tell us why. First, though, Sally, when you approach writing a book, do you know in advance if it's going to be a children's book or if it's going to be an adult book, or do you sort of have an idea and let it percolate and think, oh yes, this one falls into the adult category?
No, I'm quite clear when I do my books that this is adult, and I always was very clear about this. I have a real problem because of my name because Sally Gardner is known for children. And there's a and publishers want to put my name on the book. And it's a very difficult one to sort of say, this is adult. And I hope the covers do it. And I hope the back of the book shows that it is. But it is one of those dilemmas that I have about this. But this is definitely, definitely an adult book. And it was seen and I thought of it as an adult book. And I think it's quite important to make that difference. I think it's also, I don't know if Laura would agree, but we're in a very strange time with YA as well. Because I think in a way YA has got incredibly muddled and lost in a little bit of it. And people are now just reading whatever they want to read. I mean, the bookcase is available online without anybody policing it. They can read whatever they want. And so I'm very aware of that. And I think, you know, yes, young adults will read my book. I have no doubt about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting. And actually, I've always been in that camp because I love YA. I've always been one of those people who goes, yes, it's a YA book as categorized, but actually so many of them can just be picked up, should be picked up by anyone. That's always the camp I've sat in. And I think maybe more and more, as you're saying, Sally, that is happening. Would you say, Laura?
Yeah, definitely. I think when they've done statistics about who reads YA, an awful lot of people who read it are in their 20s or older.
Yeah.
I mean, I read YA books. And I think Sally's right saying that with everything online, you know, you're not seeing bookshelves in front of you. And those categories have really broken down. I can see why they have to be there. And I also wanted to make a division between the stuff I wrote, adult books under my own name, and have a different name for writing YA. I thought that was important, just to keep.
And
really
what a great YA name you've gone for
it.
As well.
Well, yes, it was deliberately chosen because Jamie could, of course, be male or female, and Costello was entirely Mark Billingham's fault because well, I discussed it with him, and he said, "Oh, this is what you must pick," because he's a massive fan of Elvis Costello, and also Laura Wilson. I mean, it's my own name, and I've never, when I've been married, I haven't taken my husband's name ever, and so I wanted to be further up the alphabet. Damn it! You know, I think Gardner is great because you're right in the middle there. You're kind of on the eye line, both literally and metaphorically. Wilson, you're right by the skirting board.
Yeah, me and Sally have done all right in the alphabet stakes really over time, haven't we? G and H.
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
You're right where you should be.
But yes, Jamie Costello is a fab pseudonym, and we'll come onto your book very shortly, Laura. Sally, in this latest book, Weather Woman, there are themes of magic and illusion and science and so much more. Could you just set up the story for us, please, and perhaps introduce us to Neva?
This is my publisher always says to me, tell me what your book is about in one sentence, and I never ever ever can. So this book is the about a girl called Neva Friesland. She's very young when we first meet her, and we meet her on the Frost Fair of 1789, and she knows the ice is going. She can feel the ice is going, and she's very small, and she can't understand why no one else knows this. And a tragedy leads her to be adopted by a clockmaker who makes automatons. And it is this meeting that changes her life and his life. And she has a gift, it's of telling the weather, in a time when no one looked at the skies. The sky belonged to God. You could make no judgment of it. You wore all your clothes because the weather could do anything. And her interest in this is the beginning of people beginning to look at the sky in a very, very different way and predict the weather. And so, you know, her gift is magical. But what do you do with such a gift? And when you're incredibly clever, when all you're really expected to do is get married. And so her way of dealing with this is to become a man. She becomes Eugene Jonas. As Eugene Jonas, she's phenomenal. She is utterly phenomenal. Except the trouble is she doesn't like women, though women fall in love with her. And the man she does fall in love with is completely confused by all that he feels for her. So it's not only to do with the weather up above, but it's the weather of our sexuality as well.
Oh, that's lovely. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted you to describe it in one sentence, Sally.
Thank you.
I want to come back and talk about the period that you set this in just a moment. But Laura, if I could come to you and talk about Monochrome, perhaps you could introduces to Grace here in this story and set up her story for us.
Yes. Some books have a really short gestation period and you get the idea and you get going. This had a really long one because it started with something that happened to me in 2004. I began to lose the sight in my left eye. And one of the symptoms was that I lost my colour vision. And at the time, I was living in Covent Garden, right in the middle of London, which is very bright with all the restaurants, theatres, you know, you name it. And I could walk along the street, and just by winking, I could go from colour to black and white to colour to black and white. And it was frightening, because if something goes wrong with something you've got two of, you think, well, is the other one going to go too? And I thought, will I go blind? You know, I was newly single and I was really scared. In fact, so scared that I didn't admit how scared I was until many years later. But anyway, that experience, the left eye couldn't be saved. I still do have the right one, thank God. But it made me realise quite how important colour is in our lives. And we take it for granted. But actually, it is a huge thing which makes a massive difference to how we feel, how we communicate, to safety in both the human and certainly the bird world. Don't eat red berries, whatever it is. Don't walk across when the red man's there. And just everything. And I tried to imagine what a world would be like if we all lost our colour vision. And what the doctors kept saying to me, they didn't know why this had happened, because it's quite unusual. They kept talking about toxins, which made me start thinking about toxins, which could be anything. And I began to see all these reports about what microplastics may be doing to our brains. Now, I wrote this book before COVID. And basically, the similarities have become really slightly alarming. And what we now know about microplastics possibly crossing our blood-brain barrier has also become very alarming as well, because they've found them in placenta and in sort of everywhere. So I began the book with a 16-year-old girl called Grace, who looks out of the window and sees a sunrise, but she can't see any colours, and soon nobody can see any colours. And it's about the effect that this has on the world, and it's about how, as whenever you have a disaster, there's always someone who's going to monetize that.
Just a little bit of sinister.
Yes, I mean, I think if I'd written this for adults, it would be sort of a straight evil corporation novel. But I didn't quite want to do that.
Yeah.
But it's basically, yes, it's about what we're doing to our beautiful planet.
Well, I have to say, Laura, when I was reading it, I actually did have to take a moment to look around the room and at the walls and the art on the walls, and then look out at the garden and then look at the sky and think, oh God, you know, it's so easy to take everything for granted. But, you know, colour is something I just don't think about. It's just there, isn't it? And it really did make me think reading the book.
It's there unless you turn out the lights.
Yes.
And then it's gone.
Yes.
And I think that is a very interesting thing, that maybe colour is not as fixed as we all think it is anyway, that everybody sees a red in a different key or a different shade. And I look forward to reading your book enormously. I also think it reminded me of the Day of the Triffids, that sort of awful moment where he looks out of the hospital window and realises he's totally alone, that everyone is blind and they can't see. And I think it's a fascinating thing to deal with colour. And I wonder if you still in your head, I mean, I wondered if you lost all your colour, do you still in your head see a yellow? You know, I mean, the sort of, because even with my eyes closed, I can see a yellow. And I know what a green is. But whether that is memory built, because it's not there, so it is my idea of this colour.
All the teenagers, because one or two teenagers having more malleable brains than grown up people do start to see single flashes of red, and so they're the ones that sort of agree that they will help with this experiment, which will give colour back to the world, and they think they're doing something very altruistic, but it's actually not quite that simple. And they have a lot of conversations about this. Do you still dream in colour? And what happens? Will there be a generation of babies born who will never have seen in colour? And so colour will have just gone. And it is interesting that how do you have a memory of that? And also we have a whole ton of language which is associated with colour.
Yeah.
And so many things that we would just lose.
Yes. I mean, in my book, The Weather Woman, I used colour for Neva's emotions as a way of her seeing people, because she is on the spectrum. And I thought that was quite interesting. You know, when she had no words for people, she could see they were soft like sunsets, or that they were two storms that were coming together. Yes. And she was in the middle of it. And I remember as a child feeling very, colour was very much something I associated with rooms, with people. And I had this thing about H, Joe, you might like this, that it was green. H was always
green. That's interesting.
Oh,
I don't know why. H is always green, and C is always yellow to me. I've no idea why.
How funny.
That's really, that's weird, isn't it?
Oh, well, that's me.
I do have that bit of association with colour and music, so... high notes are lighter colours and lower notes are darker colours and sort of things like that. And I think in a world without colour, it actually would affect our ability, not only the thing with people's moods, but also to listen to music as well. To just be aware of other senses.
Affect creativity.
Don't completely.
But yeah, I think it would the end. ruin creativity.
Also, what
completely.
It affects massively is eating. They've done quite a few tests, and if you don't know what colour things are, you can't always tell what flavour they are, because apparently the bit of your brain which is associated with your senses, if you're a sighted person, something like 70% of that is taken up by colour. So seeing really, really is believing. And so if you're just confronted by a grey block of ice cream, it could be coconut, it could be chocolate, it could be sort of, you know... Because we eat with our eyes.
I once made my children for Halloween, I made them a black jelly with spiders in it. And no one ate it.
I can kind of see what, It's like, I always think blue food is quite suspect. Mm. I remember as a kid going to a children's party, I must have been about seven, and they'd iced the cake pale blue. And I just thought, well, no, that's weird. That's not happening.
I'm not going near that.
Like your black jelly.
But as well as, I mean, colour in our language, which we just mentioned, weather is also a huge part of our language. We sort of have phrases about weather, or we have weather terms that relate to, you know, other things. And it's such a... And actually, colour and weather are sort of go together as well, Sally. And I do think that I've been thinking about the weather an awful lot more than I think I ever have over the past year or so, because of what it's doing, because of obviously the effect of climate change on our weather here in the UK and then around the world. It really is something now that's become more than just, you know, a person in a nice suit on the television telling us whether we need a brolly or not.
Yes, and I was very interested when it was lockdown, the sky became more colourful, because there were no planes. And now the planes have all started, the colours are going. And in the period I'm writing about, which is 1789 to 1813, the skies were much, much brighter. And it's been noted by many diarists about how the sky became more grey. And for instance, in 1813, about 1812, the snow turned black because of the pollution from the sea coal burning. Yeah. And it fell as soot, as black soot, not white, black. And I think that is something that really fascinates me. And also the other thing that fascinated me was the way the Aborigine people see the sky, and the way that... it used to be the Romani way to see the sky, and the way that Native American Indians saw the sky. And it is not as we see the sky. Somehow we have flattened it in our heads. But they saw it as huge fishing nets of colour, and that it was all connected. Even a plain sky would tell you what was happening all over the place. And we've lost all that. We don't have any of those innate abilities to know. We have a few things like, you know, red sky in the morning, da 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 da. But this was incredibly profound and a way of survival in a way for many of these communities. Anyway, I found that fascinating. And I wanted to use all that with Neva. I wanted to use the fact that she goes to see Turner and Constable and looks at it and goes, is that really how you see the sky? Yeah. Is that it? And I think that's an interesting idea.
Absolutely. You know, we used to be much sort of closer to the weather, didn't we? Literally, no double glazing, no, you know, and had much more of an effect.
And it
seems to me that we're slightly getting back to that as we think, well, I can't turn on my heating because, you know, I'm sitting here with a hot water bottle in my lap, you know. And things like that. And I think weather, it's in Shakespeare, isn't it? There's more of it. There's more. It's signs and portents and people have much more of a relationship with it. And it's also metaphorical for the weather inside you. You know, your emotional weather as well.
Yes, that's what I very much wanted to deal with, that because I think this whole set sexuality business at the moment that we're having, you are either this, that or that, is totally irrelevant. I'm sorry to say. I think that, you know, it is so fluid throughout our lives of what we might be and what we could be and what we are. Why name it? Why name it? Why not just... You know, my grandmother used to have a saying which was great. Everyone is queer except thee and me, but even thee's a bit queer. And I loved that. It was a northern saying.
Yeah.
It's right. She was right.
That reminds me of my nana a bit, actually, as well. She was from Yorkshire, and that phrase rings true. Yeah.
She had another one, which I did love as well. And because she was a teetotaler, and she had one, she said, the cup that cheers but does not inebriate, which was tea.
Very good.
Oh, yes, I remember that one.
Brilliant. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading recently and enjoying, giving them a chance to maybe shine a light on some authors we should know about or some books. Doesn't have to be something new necessarily, because I've been delving back a little bit recently into some older stuff that I should have read. Have you had a chance to read much recently, Sally? Is there anything you want to shout about?
Well, look, I read so much research books that it's really quite... I mean, the London Library in the old section on the Regency period seems to be all here in my house. So there's a lot to
read. Oh, I love the London Library, don't you?
I love the London Library. It's my favourite place. Anyway, so the book I love reading little books at the moment. I just get a joy from sort of, oh, there's one. And so the one I have just started reading is Nick Hornby's Dickens and the Prince, which I love. Ooh. I absolutely adore. It's such a random pairing, but it really works. As you know, he knows so much about music and his love of Dickens. And I have to here own up to absolutely adoring Dickens. And I lived in Four Raymond Buildings when I was a little kid, where Dickens was a clerk.
No way.
I used to love the idea of walking up the stairs and thinking, Mr. Dickens lived here. And I remember at school, they said to me, and who's your uncle? And we only had books. My father had a set of Dickens books. And I thought he was my uncle. And I remember saying, yes, Dickens is my uncle. But the really loved, I've got to tell you one rather lovely story about this, because I was at art school and I was asked to go to Bleeding Heart Yard to get the etching paper. I was doing a course on etching. And the man there was known to be incredibly aggressive. But anyway, I went there and I was charmed myself. And the place was very old. It had slatted boards where you could look down. And it was a total fire hazard. And this old man was in the corner. A very, very old man was sitting in the corner. And I said, gosh, this is in Dickens, this Bleeding Heart Yard. And the old man, who hadn't spoken at all, said, Mr. Dickens gave me a boiled sweet. And I went, what? And he said, when I was a little lad, He came into this door and he gave me a boiled sweet. So there. I mean, for me, it was just extraordinary. I felt like I had, in a way, touched history and met him.
Yeah.
It was the most... So this book, I adored it. I'm loving it. And then the other book I really loved, a slight small book, but it was great, is The Young Pretender by Michael Adetti. And I loved that. It's about an actor in the Regency period who was a supersonic star and then grows up and is no longer... You know, and it's about that, the situation. It's wonderful. I mean, so brilliant. I slip in these small books, which I...
Yes. Yeah, lovely. I love a small book. We all do. We all admit that we love a short book, don't we?
Yes, I do. I do like a short book.
And what have you been reading and enjoying recently, Laura?
Well, the small book thing definitely resonates with me because a couple of months ago, I had to review the Robert Galbraith, The Ink Black Heart, which is 1,012 pages long. And I had my first book-related injury when I was reading the book in bed. I fell asleep and it crashed down onto my nose and actually cut my eyebrow. And it was really quite shocking. I mean, the force.
Bloody hell.
The force with this thing hit my face. I actually did wonder if I was going to have a black eye in the morning. I didn't, thank goodness. There was nothing you couldn't cover up with makeup. But it would have been, you know, it's one of those, oh, I walked into a door and everyone's thinking, come off it. Well, a book fell on my face. Mwah, not good. Yeah, I'm with you about the short books, although I also love Dickens. And I think if I'd met that boy, the boiled sweet man, I would have wanted to touch him and then never washed my hands.
I did. No, that's the thing.
Good.
I said, could I shake your hand? He was very old.
Yes.
And I just thought, oh my god. And I went back with such enthusiasm to tell everyone. No one went, oh yeah, Dickens. Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible.
It's the continuum through history.
And also, I had to say about Gray's Inn, which, going back to the weather, where I grew up, was amazing because there were the pea super fogs. And I was very small and a very dyslexic little human being, got things awfully wrong about nearly everything. And I thought the fog was made up of all the dead that had lived in London and in Gray's Inn. And so when you went out, you put your hand out into it and it would disappear. So you couldn't see the end of your fingers because it had gone. And I remember thinking that you could touch Dickens, you could touch all the ghosts if you put your hand out there. And when I used to get very ill because it was so cold and we didn't have central heating, and I remember a fog came into the room and it was a green, it just hung this green ghost in the centre of my bedroom for the day. It stayed a whole day.
Yeah. Goodness me.
Yeah. You can really see how people believed in ghosts as much as they did, though.
Yeah.
It was like last year I went to Iceland for the first time and I suddenly understood why people believed in dragons.
Yeah.
Because the mountains seemed to be alive and I'd never seen that before and I sort of suddenly got it.
Yeah.
You know, that why this had been the case. But no, for books, I have been reading short books and longer books at, you know, much risk and not in bed, so there aren't any more accidents. I do read an awful lot, and in fact, I had to remind myself about this. But my new discovery is an author called E.H. Young. And the book I read was a book called Chatterton Square, which I just saw mentioned by chance on Twitter. And she was writing in the 30s and 40s. And Chatterton Square is set in a town in the west of England, which I think must be Bristol, although it's given another name. And it's set on the eve of the Second World War, and it's about these two families, one of which is very traditional. There's a patriarch who very much rules the roost. And the other family is this more bohemian family. There's a single mother, which must have been unusual then, who everyone assumes is a widow, but who actually isn't. And the patriarch really doesn't like his family associating with this other family across the way. But of course they do, because this other family appears so much more happy and relaxed and free. And it's just about what happens, how they change by interacting with these other people. And the wife of the patriarch, Bertha, is this very sort of mousy, just sort of listens to her husband. And you see her throughout the book. She begins to change and to grow. By the end of the book, she's completely, you know, and there's a point at the end where her husband says, well, what do you think of me? And she tells him. And you almost feel sorry for this guy. Almost, but not quite. Almost.
Shouldn't ask. Never ask that question.
Yeah, no, you should. But no one should ask that question. And it was just a brilliant book. And I've now got a couple of others by her, and I'm all excited to have discovered this new author, which I'm really pleased about.
And also, who was it again, Laura?
E.H. Young.
Young. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know very little about her, apart from that she had a very sort of bohemian lifestyle for the time. But apart from that, and you know, I've never come across her before. She's great.
Brill.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thank you both for those recommendations. And now it's time for another, because it's time for the book off, where each of you is going to, Sally looks scared, tell us about a book you love and you think everyone listening should read. And you're going to have 3 minutes uninterrupted if you choose to use all three to tell us about them. Now, before we get into it, a little bit of admin, ladies. We always let the person who's travelled the furthest choose if they go first or second. Now, I believe, if I'm using me as the main location, Laura has travelled the furthest, I think. I could be wrong, because Sally, you're Sussex?
Hastings.
Yeah. And I'm in Brighton.
There we go. Think
you and I'm in Hackney. So.
Yeah, so I think you get to decide if you go first or second.
I don't mind. I'm happy to go first.
Step up. Okay, fantastic. And as I said, you do get 3 whole minutes uninterrupted if you wish to use it. But if you are still talking at the... if you're still talking at the 3 minute mark, I'm either going to be ringing you out with the school bell or honking you out with the horn. So Sally, at your 3 minutes, would you rather the horn or the bell?
Oh, the bell. The horn really freaks me out. No,
yeah,
the bell.
Okay. The bell for you. All right, that means you get the horn then, Laura. So I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock. And just before we set the timer going, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
Okay, this is The Book of the Most Precious Substance. It's by an American author called Sarah Gran. And it came out 2 days ago, I think. Published by Faber.
Okay, brand new. My goodness. New. All right. Then it's over to you. 3 minutes on the clock. Off you go.
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure I'd like a book about sex magic, which is how this was described, because the occult's not really my thing. But after a few pages, I was hooked. It's a quest novel. It's set in the world of rare books. It's very well written, very perceptive. But what makes it really fly is the main character. She's called Lily Albrecht, and she's someone whose life has gone very, very right and then very, very wrong. difficult childhood. Then she's become a best-selling author with her first novel. She has a wonderful relationship with Abel, who's this cool, clever, sexy academic. They're a smart young couple. They've got money, lots of friends. But then Abel starts to lose his cognitive function. No one can put a name to his illness, but it's degenerative. After a few years, he's mute and incontinent. All their money goes on medical bills. America, no NHS. Friends desert them. Lily stops being able to write. She becomes a book dealer to keep them afloat. And the book she agrees to find for a mystery client is this Book of the Most Precious Substance. It's a rare 17th century textbook of magic, and it's rumoured to be the most powerful occult book ever written. It's a series of instructions for rituals involving sex, which, if you carry them out properly and speak the magic words, will give you untold powers. Some of the wealthiest people in the world are willing to pay a fortune for this. So if Lily can get a copy, she'll be free from the money worries. And if she carries out the rituals, she'll be able to get her husband back to health. She teams up with a customer called Lucas, and there's a frisson there from the beginning. So together they hunt down the book, they travel across America and Europe, and they do these rituals they know about. And of course, Lily starts to get all her mojo back. She starts to enjoy life again. But the people who are interested in the book keep dying. The rituals become more difficult to accomplish and things get more and more dangerous until the eventual denouement. Okay, yeah, there's a lot about sex. To be honest, those descriptions were, I thought, the least interesting parts. But they're well done, they're not gratuitous, and they're from a woman's point of view. And if I'm honest, I probably wouldn't have liked this if it had been from a guy's point of view. But ultimately, this book is not about sex. It's about obsession and resolve and the choices we make, or we think we make, and the lengths we'll go to get what we want, and how we need to be careful what we wish for. Because what really made it was the ending. It's not a fairy tale. It's very realistic. It's all very realistic for a book about magic. And I closed the book thinking, yeah, that would so exactly be what happened in that situation. And it's a terrific read, and I really, really recommend it.
Oh, my goodness.
Very good.
20 seconds to spare, Laura. You really did race through it. You were like... Fabulous pitch. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment, but you can have a breather now. Look, I think you need it. And have some more tea. I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock for you now, Sally. And before we launch into it, you look so nervous.
I am.
Just before we launch into it, tell us the book you're putting forward.
I'm putting forward Raymond Radiguet's The Devil in the Flesh.
Fantastic. All right. Okay. 3 minutes on the clock. Over to you then.
The novel takes place at F, a provincial town outside Paris. A story about a 16-year-old boy, an affair with a married woman of 19 called Martha. It is set in the last year of the First World War, while her husband is still fighting in the trenches, not far from Paris. The imagery in it is extraordinary, the writing hard-edged as a diamond. The novel caused a scandal and still today has the power to shock. It became a runaway bestseller. Not many first novels received the accolades that The Devil in the Flesh did. Raymond Radiguet was the oldest of seven children. At 15, he had his first affair, which became the basis for The Devil in the Flesh. Bored with school, he left to go to Paris, where he became embroiled with the literary and art world. He knew Pablo Picasso, Modigliani, among others, and his eventual meeting with Jean Cocteau that ultimately changed his life. He was introduced to Cocteau at an art gallery. He described the boy as having bad hair and a pocket full of screwed up poems that when he read to him, convinced him he was a genius. Raymond Radiguet had sketched out the early episodes of this book in 1919, but it was not until the summer of 1921 that he sat down to write the novel. There is a passage in it that foreshadowed his own death. He wrote, "An untidy man who is about to die, but does not suspect it, suddenly puts everything around him in order. His life changes, he sorts out his papers, he gets up early, goes to bed early, and gives up his vice, and those around him rejoice, so that his brutal death seems all the more unjust. He was about to lead a happy life." His publishers decided to launch the book on a scale unknown in France. The strapline used was, "I have discovered a 17-year-old author." One critic wrote, "I don't care whether the author is 17 or 107. It's the book we have to judge, not his birth certificate." Rainer Maradiguet said to Jean Cocteau just before he died, "There is a colour that moves and people hidden in the colour." Cocteau asked him, "Shall I send them away?" He said, "You can't send them away. You can't see the colour." Cocteau said he died without knowing it. He was just 20. His age doesn't matter. This is a book that is timeless, yet it's a triumph. It trumpets in the culture of youth. Rainer Maradiguet was an extraordinary writer. His language simple, his cruel knife sharp on the frailty of love and the mismatch of man and woman. It is a book I have returned to many times and it always amazes me.
Wonderful. Again, 15 seconds to spare, Sally. You brought it in just under the wire, and what a fab pitch it was as well. Thank you so much. You can have a rest now because we're going back to talk about The Book of the Most Precious Substance, brand new, by Sarah Gran. And Laura, I love that you opened with, and I would have said the same thing, that you didn't think you would be up for a book about sex magic, but actually it was perhaps not quite what you thought. Now, I've heard about this book already. A few people have been talking about it and saying very good things, as have you. But I loved that what you were saying is, you know, it not only has it got great characters in it, but that actually it's not a fairy tale. And you said, you know, having read it at the end, yes, that is what would happen. So it's got that, it's sex magic one side, but actually a sort of reality to it as well.
Yeah, for a book that is about magic, it's actually very sort of grounded in reality and just the complete random shit that happens in your life. You know, there this couple are, everything's going great for them, and there's suddenly this curveball that this guy mixes up tea and coffee, he forgets where he's going, and slowly she realizes that their lives are just closing right down, and they're, you know, just dwindling away. And I can just see so exactly how that might happen. And it's also very good on the world of rare book collecting and the quite sort of strange characters that you find there, which I think the author has done a bit of herself. She's been a book dealer and also set up a small publishing house, I think, to publish this book in America. Wow. Sarah Gran. Yeah.
Brilliant.
And
I did like that you said, you know, it's the sex isn't gratuitous, actually, even though there's a lot of it. And actually, it's well done. And it's from the female gaze as well.
Yes. I mean, there is quite a lot of it. And there are bits where we get a bit sort of Story of O-ish, you know, and like hashtag lesbian BDSM or whatever. But, you know, as I say, though, they were fine, those bits, but that wasn't what kept me reading it, you know. Mm. And if you like spicy books, really, Philip would go for it. Philip Boots, this will really suit you for that reason.
Sounds
but,
fab.
But it was just the journey and, you know, what happened to her. And she recovers her mojo in every way possible with writing and life and everything. But then, of course, at the end, it's that thing that life often gives us both more and less than we wish for, sort of in one and the same time.
Yeah. That's a brilliant pitch. I really loved it, Laura. So thank you for that. And I loved yours, Sally. I don't know The Devil in the Flesh. And after hearing you talk about it, I think I absolutely need to. The way you talked about the sort of imagery in the book and the hard-edged writing that still has the power to shock is amazing for someone, again, you know, we should maybe dwell on the age, but someone who was so young and that managed to sort of produce this amazing
work.
Dwell on the age,
because it is extraordinary.
Yeah.
He is a brutal, brutal narrator.
Yeah.
He's cruel. But he's cruel with the honesty of youth. There's no lie in this.
Right.
There's no fat. There's nothing in it. It's as lean can be. Its writing is shocking. And the nib goes in. The nib goes deep into you. And the one image that starts in this book, which I read it when I was 18, and I was totally blown away by it. And the copy I had, though I can't find it, he writes a little essay about why do not dismiss youth. And actually, it is a forerunner to the youth culture that we're about to explode into.
Mm.
And that the image was of a little boy, the narrator, on his father's shoulders, looking up at the maid next door, who's threatening to jump off the roof, while over the way there is a funfair. So there is all the joy of the funfair, the lights of the funfair, and the boy can't, you know, is looking at the maid, but also turning so he's not going to miss the funfair. And there is that, it's an extraordinary piece of writing. Yeah. And I won't go into what happens, but it sort of takes your breath away.
And the sort of quote from Cocteau is brilliant, and the fact that meeting him sort of changed Raymond's life, yeah, and unbelievable that he died at just 20. You know, I mean, everything about it is sort of, it's like a film, isn't it? He got ill.
He was doing the proof. It was delayed because the publisher wanted to give it this huge and also it was very shocking because the man who believed it was his wife that had the affair became obsessed by this book, and the people who'd fought, the French who'd fought in the war, were very, very upset by it. There was huge legions of people going, it should be banned, it shouldn't be published. And in fact, it sort of ruined their lives, this book. It did. It had another life after he died. Right. It's a fascinating story. The book itself is a fascinating story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sounds like an amazing book. And then also everything that surrounds the actual publishing of this book is in itself a story.
I sort of felt I had to give... It wasn't as good. I couldn't just do the book.
No.
Because without sort of knowing that this boy was so young. I mean, he started publishing at 15 and he dies at 20. Yeah. And by which time he's written a masterpiece that will, as long as books are published, will always be there. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
I love that. And that's a fascinating story. And I really want to read it. I really want to read both of these books, actually. You've both done an amazing job of selling them to me. It's a toughie, as it always is, but I think on this occasion, I'm going to take the Raymond Radiguet. The Devil in the Flesh sounds like it needs to be read, and soon. So I'm going to go and find a copy.
And also, can I just say it's not too long?
Oh, yes. It's not too long anyway. Yes. A bonus.
That's a bonus. Definitely a bonus. I'm going to hunt it down.
Thank you both again for those recommendations and all your recommendations. And here's two others for you. Weather Woman by Sally Gardner, which is out now and it's published by Head of Zeus, and Monochrome by Jamie Costello, aka Laura Wilson, is also out now and that's published by Atom, and they deserve a place on your shelves. Sally, Laura, what an absolute joy it's been to spend this time with you. Thanks so much for joining us, and hopefully I'll see you in the flesh next time, probably, Laura, over a dinner.
Yes, with food. Thank you very much.
With food. And thank Sally, you. maybe we'll go for a little seaside walk at some point.
I'd love that.
Thank you both.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.